Despite problems with bee populations, there are still many pollinators at work keeping our plants growing and thriving. And the beekeepers around Southern Oregon will be sharing their secrets at an upcoming bee school, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Joining us this morning is Dr. Dewey Caron, a professor of horticulture at Oregon State University and the author of the book Honey Bee Biology. Dr. Dewey Caron, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, tell us a little bit. I want to start off with a general question. Of course, in the news over the last few years, there's been concerns about bee population in the United States. I wondered if you had an update, any thoughts on that at present, and how the bee population in Oregon might specifically be doing.
Yeah, you have heard correctly. There have been some issues. We've been surveying now, this is our eighth year in a row, both in Oregon and across the U.S. Levels are about one in three colonies do not survive. That's better than the colonies that are in the wild, that are in bee trees, colonies that are inside the buildings, that those type of locations. But it's still a pretty high level. I wish that we could say specifically what seems to be the issue. However, it does appear that it's a combination of factors, an introduced mite, happening, some virus epidemics, some common colds of bees, but some of them seem to reach epidemic levels. And we think declining pasturage for bees, the flowers that they must get out to, is also adding a stress factor that may then facilitate these epidemics of the common disease pathogens to get started.
Is the problem getting worse or getting any better?
It really has been about the same. We had a lovely spring in much of the U.S. a couple years ago, and good weather cures all. The bees can get out to the flowers, their hive warms up better, damp, cold, confined conditions are improved, and that helps improve diminish the possibilities for these disease pathogens to grow within the colony. We can supplement their feed, and beekeepers do, by feeding them sugar water and even supplemental protein. But if there's nothing like good weather to get out and get to the flowers. Although we've got a lot now in bloom in the valley, they may not have a full day to be able to get out and take advantage of it. So they're still somewhat confined. In some springs, it just the spring seems to linger on, and the condition seems to be exacerbated.
When it comes to horticulture, I think sometimes people forget about beekeeping, and I was wondering how common is beekeeping in our area, either as a hobby or something more like a commercial enterprise?
The vast majority of beekeepers are what we would call hobbyists or backyard beekeepers. The average number of colonies is like three per individual. Many have just a single colony. On the other end of the spectrum, we do have what we call commercial beekeepers, individuals earning their majority of their income or all of their income from the management, keeping of bees for honey and for their services in pollination. Those individuals may have up to 15,000 colonies. But a common number with one or two helpers is in the area of 2,000 to 3,000 colonies that they maintain. And they're residents of the valley and the state for maybe only part of the year. They may hire long-haul truckers, flatbed trucks, to move them to California for pollination of almonds. They may over summer in better pasture up in Montana or perhaps in the Dakotas. So they're Oregon residents, and their bees are in Oregon maybe only part of the year.
What type of bees do well in our climate here?
Well, the bee that we keep, the one that we say in beekeeping, the honeybee, is actually not a native of North America. It was bought by the earlier colonists to the East Coast. As we settled the East Coast, we have a record as early as 1622 of honeybees being brought over on a ship during the wintertime from Europe over to Massachusetts, to the Bay County. So they then spread, as we spread, westward and southward, and we have records of bees coming into the Willamette Valley of Oregon, almost with some of the very first settlers that came in overland from the from the Midwest, from the jump off points in Kansas and Nebraska. So we've had bees here in the state for quite a while. The bee that we have from Europe is also called an Italian bee. It's a bee that is developed on the peninsula of Italy into the Mediterranean. And although there's varying climates in Italy from the high mountains to the southern portions that are hot and dry, it seems to be the bee best adapted for the variety conditions we have in the U.S. So most of our Oregon beekeepers are keeping what we call Italian honeybees.
Now, at the Southern Oregon Extension Center on Saturday, April 19th, there will be a bee school. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, exactly. In cooperation with the Jackson County Extension Office, there is a Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. It does meet at the Extension Office on a regular basis, the first Monday of the month, actually. And now for several years, they've organized for the people that want to get started, primarily directed towards those that are thinking about bees or have had thoughts about bees or have actually started the process, what we call our bee school. It's a full day where we go over the basics of what we do with bees, how we get them established, get the colony started, characteristics of a good place to keep them in your yard or on some farm property if you have it, rural property, and then their basics of that first season. What kind of things do you do? How would you determine if they could be supplemented with feed, and how do you feed them with sugar water? We also will have live bees there on the property, and so part of the session is also to actually go out and look in colony, look at what we look at when we do manage them, when we do open them up and inspect them, and a little bit about what we might expect from starting a bee colony the first year, how to start, and then what you might expect from the first couple of years.
If you have a question for Dr. Karen, you can reach us at 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe you've been thinking about getting into beekeeping, or perhaps you have some bees and you might have some questions about those. One of my questions regards fear. I know a lot of people are afraid of bees. Many of us have been stung a few times in our life. How do you get people to move past that fear?
That's always an issue, and there certainly are some individuals that will not make a good beekeeper, those that can't get over that trepidation, that fear that they're going to be stung. And there are a few individuals where the sting is more irritating, and even a smaller number, but very seriously, people that could be allergic to a sting, so they should not they should avoid trying to be stung, whether it's a yellow jacket or a honeybee or whatever. Our most common stinging insect in Oregon is a wasp, a relative of honeybees, what we call the yellow jacket. They're the issue in the fall, but of course, keeping bee colonies, there's always the chance of being stung. Our beekeepers are prepared. They'll have a jacket or coveralls that has a veil that covers the face, and we use a couple of instruments to try to reduce the chance of releasing the behavior of stinging when we enter a colony, but there still is the chance. It comes a little bit with knowing the terrain, knowing what to expect when you look in a bee colony. That's why we're actually doing this session of going into a colony in the course. And at some point, I'll say in the course that at some point you'll actually become a beekeeper. You'll be thinking about what the bees are doing and not be thinking of, is that bee going to sting me or am I going to get stung if I go in the colony?
Move beyond that. We have a call from Pam in Dexter. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi. Well, I've been working with the Oregon Sustainable Beekeepers on the issue of the neonicotinoids, which are increasing the bee die-offs. And last winter, the beekeepers reported losses of 40 to 90% of their hives, the worst year yet since the global bee die-off began. And I'm just wondering why your guest hasn't even mentioned that. And they've done studies and found that higher-income neighborhoods where people can afford the neonicotinoids have more bee die-offs, and in the cities there's more bee die-offs because more of these neonics are being sprayed, and they're also endemic in the plant, so it takes almost the whole life of the plant. These neonics are in the actual pollen that the bees get. So I'm just wondering why your guest isn't mentioning that. And I know that Bayer is one of the makers of these neonics. They did a bee care tour at OSU about a month ago, and we went up there, and they're kind of doing a greenwash, making it sound like the neonics are not threatening the bees, even though the European Union has banned them until further study, because there's more and more evidence showing that these are harming the bees. So if you could talk about that for a minute, that'd be great.
Dr. Karen?
Thanks, Pam, for the question. And indeed, I mentioned stressors of bees in the earlier question, and I mentioned things such as poor weather, these pathogens that are endemic, and then something triggers off an epidemic of rapid growth. Nutrition is one of the factors that we know that can do this. And as you have mentioned, another we feel could be pesticide exposure to pesticide. Now, bees get exposed to pesticides as they go to flowers to get their resources, and homeowners applying pesticides as well as producers of ag crops apply pesticides. We know that pesticides are registered, of course, with the Environmental Protection Agency, and the way that pesticides are actually used by the homeowner or by the ag producer is not part of the requirements. When a company such as Bayer, which you've mentioned, registers a material, they register the technical material, the active ingredient, the killing agent. But you buy that, plus you buy what is on the label is called inert ingredients, and you buy and you may apply the material in a number of ways. That is not required in the registration. In the ability to register a compound, they do have to test for side effects against beneficials, and honeybees are one of the major ones that is tested. This category of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, are relatively new in terms of pesticides. They only go back several years. And as you have indicated, there's growing correlations and growing evidence that the registration process does not adequately address how these things may be affecting beneficial insects, and particularly honeybees. So we are very, very concerned about this aspect. The level of losses that you have cited, 40 to 90% is true, 40% for our backyard beekeepers, 42 last year, but half of that for our commercial beekeepers. So our beekeepers are doing some things to try to avoid that loss, including exposure to the neonicotinoids. But it is one of those stress factors. The stress factors then lead to the possibility of having a higher level of one of the disease pathogens, in this case not a virus, but a fungus that's in the colony. And again, the wet spring, cool spring, favors a fungus growth. And so those combinations of pesticide exposure plus the fungus pathogen can lead to heavier losses some springs, and we've had some springs where we have had losses higher than roughly the 30% that I quoted.
Joining us this morning is Dr. Dewey Karen, professor of horticulture at Oregon State University. We're talking about beekeeping. If you have a question, 800-838-3760, or in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. We have Ginger with us from Talent. Go ahead, Ginger.
Yes, my question kind of relates to the last caller, Pam. I live in the middle of a pear orchard, and I don't own it, but my house happens to be surrounded by pear trees. And I notice year after year after year, the orchardists place bees in the orchards, you know, for pollination purposes, and then they will proceed to spray, I'm assuming, and I don't know exactly what all they're spraying. They're spraying fungicides, I know, in the spring for sure, and probably some pesticides later in the spring. I just don't know exactly. And just, it puzzles me that they place the bees there and then proceed to spray with these high-powered sprayers, which go up and down the rows, you know, row after row after row. And I'm hoping at least they don't spray directly on the beehives. I'm guessing they don't do that. But nevertheless, that high amount of spray is in the atmosphere, in the environment, and the bees are, you know, going about doing their job. It seems just counterintuitive that they do that.
Yeah, why would
indeed
they?
It does, and it can be an issue. The bees are needed in pairs, apples, blueberries, about two dozen common Oregon crops, for the period of the flowering of the crop. So they're actually needed in the pear orchard only during that time. During that time, because of the possibility of killing bees and exposure to the pesticide, the growers will not be using material that is highly toxic to honeybees. Indeed, most of the sprays at that time are fungicides. So the harm that we've seen in honeybees has been in that pollination situation, which they're absolutely necessary. You have to have an insect transfer the pollen to be able to grow the pears later in the season. They are helping. They're not purposefully harming the colonies. Now, in line with the last caller, one of the things we have found of recent is that there may be some synergistic action between compounds, pesticide compounds. So we've always considered that the fungicides are relatively harmless when bees are exposed to them. That is, if you put bees in a cage, you spray right over top of them, most of the bees will survive. It will be a very normal level of survival. However, sometimes with exposure to some of the other compounds or other compounds that the grower may apply at the same time that they're applying that fungicide may create harm. It may be the interactions between the chemicals or the fact that they're not only just spraying the fungicide, they're also putting an insecticide in there, in some cases just in case, essentially as an insurance. So there is some exposure to bees. For this reason, we've had some of these losses, these very heavy losses. And as I indicated, it's a combination of factors. The bees can often stand one insult, the fungicide, but then you start combining these things with a poor spring, the endemic disease pathogens, and sometimes a mixture of different chemicals, and then you get the loss of bees. The growers are paying for the bees to be in the orchard, so it's not to their advantage to kill the colonies, because then they won't have the beekeeper returning with bee colonies for another season. So they are taking some safeguards. Is it enough? Is it adequate? That's part of what is happening with bees, and part of the reason we were having heavy losses because not all growers are as conscientious and not all things that are being done are adequate safeguards these days.
Ken is on the line from Medford. A question about regulation. Go ahead, Ken.
Yes, I was wondering what, if any, prohibitions or restrictions there are for a homeowner to have a backyard beekeeping setup.
Thank you, Ken.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Ken. Great question. There are a couple communities that do regulate further north. Springfield, adjacent to Eugene, has such regulation. In the city of Portland, there is a regulation that you have to get concurrence of your neighbors. Ashland has recently changed their regulations and are now much more bee-friendly. And in fact, many cities across the U.S., big cities, New York, Madison, Wisconsin, Los Angeles, for example, Washington, D.C., have within the last couple of years relaxed any restrictions. Some of them had outright bans. You could not keep bees in the city. The problem with that is it bans the beekeeper, but not the bees, because the bees will still be in bee trees and sides of buildings, and so the potential hazard from a sting or a bee stinging an allergic person is not reduced by banning colonies and of beekeepers. And so that's not the good application of our technology that we need of the information.
In the short so term?
In most cases, no. The backyards are not convenient for lots of colonies. So, one, two, three colonies. We like to have them away from buildings per se, except you're all maybe behind the garage, but right adjacent to a neighbor's property. And if there's a public walkway, a sidewalk or something, a simple fence gets the bees to drive up, fly up and over people's heads, so there wouldn't happen to be a chance of a pedestrian, a person on a sidewalk colliding with a bee trying to return to its home. So that's, and we do recommend water in the suburban areas, particularly when it gets dry in the summer here. The bees need water to dilute their food, and so providing a water source right close to the bees, right within the same location, is a good, adequate safeguard to help keep them at home, at least when they're foraging for water.
Dr. Dewey Caron has been our guest this morning, a professor of horticulture at Oregon State University, and will be a guest at an upcoming bee school that we'll be having here in Southern Oregon out at the Extension Center in Central Point on April 19th. Dr. Caron, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And if you'd like more information on that, you can contact the Extension Center to find out. In our next half hour, we're going to be talking about the efforts by the city of Eugene to deal with the homeless population in that community. But first, we have the Writer's Almanac up next with Garrison Keeler.